Good evening, everyone. Let's turn in our Bibles, please, to the book of Job, chapter 19. We have been considering this Old Testament saint, Job, and some of the difficulties that God either directed or allowed him to experience. We underscore what has been said, that this is an epic on revival. This is a treatise on revival, if you please. There are times in life when we experience adverse circumstances, difficulties, and life makes no sense. There are times when the feathers hit the fan and our world is turned completely upside down. And it will make no sense unless we apply the principles of Job to our life and maintain the attitude that our confidence is in God. Though we don't know, though we don't understand why things are directed, why they are allowed to keep running the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus with the attitude that our confidence is in the Lord. Now, we said that this book of Job, the story of Job, would fall into three acts, I believe. In Act chapter 1, we consider Job in the hands of Satan. We think of how he faced calamity, compassed with blessing, crippled with bankruptcy, crushed by bereavement, covered with boils, and cursed with bitterness. How he faced calamity. But he came through it very well. And what Satan was not able to accomplish, having Job in his hands, Job's friends came close, if not altogether accomplished, what Satan could not. Because in Acts chapter 2, we think of Job in the hands of men, and we think of how he faced criticism. But in chapter 19, I wanted you to just glance over the chapter. We're going to go to other portions of the book, but I just wanted you to glance over this chapter to try to get some thinking of how Job viewed his situation. What were his personal feelings as he was there on the ash heap, covered with boils, scraping himself with a potsherd, thinking of his 10 children having died, thinking of what his wife had said, using the very words of Satan to curse God and die. What were his personal feelings as he was passing through this crushing experience? Well, he likens himself to the following, as you will see in chapter 19. First of all, he likens himself to a man taken in a net without hope of escape. Verse 6. He thinks of himself as a man in a court of law pleading for justice, but not given a hearing. Verse 7, as a wanderer lost in byways in deep darkness. Verse 8, as a king dethroned and humiliated. Verse 9, as a tree stripped, felled, and destroyed. In verse 10, as a city besieged by strong enemies. Verses 11 and 12, as a lonely outcast. Verses 13 and 14. As a despised foreigner, even in his own house. Verse 15. And then as a master insulted and ignored by his servants. Verse 16. And as a man who had lost his wife's affection, mocked by little children, abhorred by his dearest friends, and tormented by a terrible disease. verses 17 through 20. Now, to such a state, the greatest of all the men of the East, according to God's testimony, was reduced to this predicament as Satan attempted to discredit the character and piety of this man called Job. Now, thus far, we have noted some of the agents which were used by Satan for the accomplishment of his diabolical purpose. And the whole story of Job would be unrelieved blackness, but for one all-important feature. God was overseeing it all. He was there in the shadows, if you please, but he was there. The omniscient, the omnipresent, the omnipotent God was there. And behind every fiery dart, every brutal blow, behind the accumulation of sorrow and pain, was the unseen but ever-present God who was overseeing it all. You know, that's good to know. We quote the verses, we know them, that he has promised never to leave us nor forsake us. And yet when we face far less difficulty, we are inclined to give up. Keep in mind that in all of this, Job did not sin against God or charge God foolishly. And how many times have we, facing far less than what Job faced, are inclined to give up and to give in and to walk away? Now, God was well aware of the fact that Job was going through such a crushing experience, but God knew, too, that in and through this crushing experience, there would issue a greater spiritual development which would result in a more positive sanctification for his beloved servant, Job. And so we last saw him sitting on the ash heap as he was in agony in the hands of Satan facing calamity. But now let's consider Job in the hands of men and how he faced criticism. I want you to turn to Job chapter 2. Because now we think about Job's comforters. The term Job's comforters is a familiar phrase for describing people whose help only makes matters worse, only makes you feel worse. But there are some commendable things said about these men, I believe. There are some admirable qualities here concerning these men. Let me point out just a few of them to you. You'll see this in Job chapter 2. In spite of how they persecuted Job, they cared enough to travel, it seems, long distances to see Job. And they came from different directions, and they had evidently communicated in some way with each other. They came together by appointment. And keep in mind that when they came to Job, they didn't sit in a comfortable home with him for this time, particularly for the 7 days before any conversation went on. How long they talked, we aren't sure, but at least there were 7 days of silence. Now, they didn't sit in a comfortable home or in a nice, clean hospital with Job during that time. They were with him on the ash heap. And their own grief was so great, they couldn't speak for 7 days. And as we'll see, Job later wished that they hadn't said anything at all. Now, their expression for grief was like mourning for the death of a great person. So, there are some admirable qualities about these men. But what they did is not the way to do hospital visitation. Now, suppose you were terribly sick in the hospital, terribly sick, and suppose some friends came in, and they decided to take some turns at this, that at least one of them would be there to just observe you day and night for 7 days, and just look at you, and maybe shake their heads occasionally, and just look at you and stare at you. How would you feel? Well, we don't know just what their thinking was during the times of the silence. We don't know what Job's thinking was altogether. But we come to some conclusions later by what he said. After 7 days of silence, he said, "I wish I were dead." He cursed the day of his conception, and he cursed the day of his birth. Now, this is certainly no basis for permitting or allowing suicide. Look down at chapter 3. It was interesting as I was reading today. You know, when we think of conception taking place, we read, "There is a man child conceived." He was a human being right from the beginning, as is every child when conceived. I believe life begins at conception, don't you? A man-child conceived. Not some protoplasm, not some glob. He was a person right from the beginning. But he cursed the day of his conception, and he cursed the day of his birth. But this is not the way to do hospital visitation. I remember when we first moved to Greensboro, North Carolina, back in 1969, dear brother Pete Allen. He was an outstanding brother. I remember brother H.D. McKay said of him one time, he was a one-talent man who did a five-talent job. And indeed he was. But he was one, when we would go into ACU, if we could get in there, or ICU at times, he would go in when a person was in so much discomfort, and he would read Psalm 119. I'm exaggerating a little bit, but this is not the way to do hospital visitation. These men just sat with Job for 7 days. Now, it seems from later discussion that they had assumed that all of his sorrow and difficulty had come about because of sin in his life. And they evidently thought that was the case with his children who had died. You know, during all of that silence, they had plenty of time to think. What were they thinking? I don't know. Maybe they were thinking something like this. Well, when Job finds the courage to speak, he will pour out his heart. He will confess his sin. We're his friends. He'll make a clean breast of it. And if he's hesitant, we'll encourage him a little bit in this, to confess it all, to deal with it before God. We'll encourage him a little bit by talking to him and encouraging him to get it out into the open, get rid of it, deal with it before God. Well, when Job said the things that he said, well, they began to speak as they did to Job. Now, no doubt Job had counted on his friends to be of some help and to address not so much his words, but the needs of his heart. You know, it is remarkable and contradictory that one who withstood the enemy with fortitude when alone became so embittered in the presence of his friends. You know, that sometimes happens. Can it be that a man who sustained adversity without complaint when alone became so resentful at the presence of friendly and pitying onlookers? Well, it can be so, and it was so in this case. Undoubtedly, there lay hidden, far beyond the reach of Satan even, a spring of pride which only came to light when his friends, who were there in his presence, remembering a fellowship of happier days, were permitted to look so steadily and knowingly upon the ruin of a former greatness. And this is what had to be dealt with in Job. You see, there was something in Job that even he was not aware of. God was. And it's going to have to come out. It's going to be dealt with before there can be increase in the life of Job. Great though he was, God had something greater in mind for his servant. And the same is true with you and me. Regardless of how well situated we might think we are on the mountaintop of spiritual experience, there is more that God wants to do in us and with us that he might do through us, to his honor and glory. And God shows with what skill he can select and use the instruments for his purpose. And so Job must be dealt with. So, in thinking about his three friends coming, now the discussion begins. Well, I say discussion. It began with a discussion. It soon became a debate, and then a dispute. Now, from chapter 4 onward, we read of three friends. There's the fourth, Elihu, on back further in the book. But from chapter 4 onward, we have a series of dialogues between these three friends, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. And most of the book is what these three fellows said to Job and what Job said to them. It is rather laborious reading. It is rather difficult reading in some ways. But if you haven't read it, I would encourage you to do so and meditate upon it. We're just going to scan over some of the portions tonight. So, these three friends came. Verse 11 of chapter 2, now when Job's three friends heard of all this evil that was come upon him, they came every one from his own place, Eliphaz the Temanite, and Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite, for they had made an appointment together to come to mourn with him and to comfort him. Keep in mind now, when they saw him, they did not even know him. And then Job opened his mouth in chapter 3 after these 7 days and cursed his day. Now, chapter 4. Here is Eliphaz. This man is the philosopher. He is the mystic. He's the man with the exotic experience. Read what he had to say. He tells Job about this spiritual experience, this vision that he had. And you will sense as you read about this man Eliphaz that he seems to have the attitude, if you haven't had my experience, brother, I'm doubtful that you're even saved. Here is a man with dreams, with visions, and with spirits, Eliphaz the philosopher. He suggested that Job had sinned. I want you to look at verses 3 through 5 of chapter 4. Behold, thou hast instructed many, and thou hast strengthened the weak hands. Thy words have upholden him that was falling, and thou hast strengthened the feeble knees. But now it is come upon thee, and thou faintest. It toucheth thee, and thou art troubled. Job! Man, get a hold of yourself. You have been used in the lives of so many others. When others have faced difficulty, when they have gone through trying circumstances, you've been a help to them. You've been an encouragement to them. And now it's come upon you and you want to give up. Well, that's one way to comfort them, isn't it? Look at verse 7. Remember, I pray thee, whoever perished being innocent, or where were the righteous cut off? Whoever perished being innocent. Job, you know, as we think about this, it seems that you're not innocent in this. He suggested that Job had sinned. Whoever heard of the righteous being cut off? Listen, a number of martyrs, a number of people who have given their lives for the cause of Christ could rise up and say, we have. And so Eliphaz speaks. I want you to look at chapter 5 and verse 17. Now here's a good way to do some hospital visitation, or in the home for that matter, when someone is really facing some difficult times. Chapter 5, verse 17. Behold, happy is the man whom God correcteth. Therefore, despise not thou the chastening of the Almighty. Job, you should be happy. God is dealing with you. He wants to correct you. You're receiving punishment for the wrong that you have done. Count it all joy. Let's sing a song together. Let's praise the Lord. Job's response. You'll see this in chapter 6. Job speaks to his friends, and then in chapter 7, his appeal is to the Lord. Well, come down to chapter 8. Now here's the second friend, Bildad, speaking. It seems that they're taking the order according to their age. That seems to be the case. Then answered Bildad the Shuhite and said, how long wilt thou speak these things? And how long shall the words of thy mouth be like a strong wind? My, that's a good one, isn't it? After 7 days of observing this man in his condition, Job, you just keep on talking. How long are you going to do that? Why, you sound like a blustery wind. That'll encourage you. Now, Bildad is the traditionalist. He's long on tradition. And he, too, makes some assumptions. Eliphaz suggested that Job has sinned. Bildad supposes Job had sinned. You will see he bluntly called him a hypocrite in verse 13. And here was a man with clever cliches. Has a pet proverb, a pat answer for everything. No matter what it is, he has a verse to hit you with. So he likens him to a blustery wind in verse 2. Look at verse 4. If thy children have sinned against him, and he hath cast them away for their transgression, if thou wouldest seek unto God betimes, and make thy supplication to the Almighty, if thou wert pure and upright, surely now he would awake for thee, and make the habitation of thy righteousness prosperous. Job, quite evidently your children sinned, and God has taken them. Now, you think of this man on the ash heap, and maybe he's looking over at 10 grave sites over there. And his friend says something like this. It's quite evident that your children have sinned, God has taken them, but it's not too late for you, man. Get right with God. Look at verse 20. Behold, God will not cast away a perfect man, neither will he help the evildoers. And so, in chapter 9, Job speaks. And you really need to read these chapters. Look at chapter 10 and verse 7. Thou knowest that I am not wicked. And there is none that can deliver out of thine hand. I am not wicked, he says. And Job holds on to his righteousness. Well, we come to chapter 11, and here's the third friend. This is Zophar. Zophar is the dogmatist. His mind is made up. He seems to be the youngest. He was sometimes right, sometimes wrong, but never uncertain. He knows what God will say. He knows what God will do. And if you want to know anything about God, ask Zophar. And he's the worst of the three. He doesn't suggest that Job had sinned. He doesn't suppose or simply suppose that Job had sinned. He says he did so. Now, these three each had their rounds at Job. You see now, I suppose they were expecting Job to really just open up and confess a lot of sin in his life, the reason all of this. But since he did not, then they continued on this way. So they all had their rounds at Job. All three went at him two times, and two of them went at him three times. Now, Job answers back, always in agony, sometimes in anger, sometimes in assurance. I believe it was You need not turn there. I'll read it for you. I believe it was chapter 19 that Brother Billy Albury quoted. Chapter 19 and verse 25. For I know that my Redeemer liveth, and that he shall stand at the latter day upon the earth. And though after my skin worms destroy this body, yet in my flesh shall I see God. Now that's assured, isn't it? And you will not find anything on the bodily resurrection like Job said until you come to 1 Corinthians chapter 15. So sometimes he answers with assurance. And Job comes very close, if not altogether, accusing God, making accusation against God. But now I want you to go back, and I just want to skim over some of the things that Job said to these ones. Come down to chapter 12. Chapter 12. And Job answered and said, no doubt, but you are the people, and wisdom shall die with you. That's quite an answer, isn't it? You are the people, he said. You are the epitome of wisdom. And when you die, wisdom will be gone. Look over at chapter 13. Verse 4, but ye are forgers of lies. Ye are all physicians of no value. Oh, that ye would altogether hold your peace, and it should be to your wisdom. You fellas, says Job, you fellas who are supposed to be my friends, if you were to keep quiet, somebody just might make the mistake and think you're wise. Verse 13 of chapter 13, hold your peace and let me alone. Look at chapter 16. Chapter 16. Then Job answered and said, I have heard many such things. Miserable comforters are ye all. And back in 15, when Eliphaz comes at him the second time, he says, Job, you condemn yourself with your own talking. All of this talking. Look at chapter 17. But as for you all, do ye return and come now, for I cannot find one wise man among you. Then in chapter 19, he said, how long will you vex my soul and break me in pieces? Chapter 19, verse 22, why do you persecute me as God and are not satisfied with my flesh? Here is one that, let me see if I can find it now. Oh, yes, chapter 30. I want you to look at that before we close. Chapter 30. But now they that are younger than I have me in derision, whose fathers I would have disdained to have set with the dogs of my flock. Boy, that was sarcasm on Job's part, wasn't it? Why, he says, I wouldn't have your father sitting with my dogs in the pen. Miserable comforters are you all. And then in chapter 32, here comes Elihu, and he seems to be the youngest of these friends. He's a fourth individual here. But he comes in, he's angry with Job as well as the three friends. And he gives his opinion. Chapter 32 and verse 10, his opinion. And in what he had to say, maybe he comes the closest of being right. But everybody in the book was wrong. Mrs. Job was wrong. Eliphaz was wrong. Bildad was wrong. Zophar was wrong. Elihu was wrong. And Job was wrong. Being right. You know, we can be wrong being right. How does it go? Here lies Billy Bray, who died while having the right of way. He was right. He was dead right as he drove along. But he's just as dead if he had been wrong. You can be wrong being right. And Job was holding on to his righteousness. And God had to deal with it. You know, in our assumptions, in our assessments, we're often wrong, aren't we? Now you think about that. We're often wrong. Oh, we come to our conclusions as to how things are, and we say things, but oftentimes we are wrong. This is the reason we should be very careful what we say and how we say something, because we don't have all of the factors that enter into the equation. Recently, I was over in Green Turtle. I borrowed the truck of Gene Lowe to go from Treasure Key to Marsh Harbor. What is it, about 22 miles, something like that. So we got into Marsh Harbor. Louise and I were coming back. I pulled into the station, and I said, well, I think maybe $20 worth of gas will do it. So I pulled into the station, and the young man there said something to me about the tank. I said, $20 worth. I gave him the $20. He went inside, and I got into the truck. We drove off. As I was going down the highway, I looked at the gauge. I said, Louise, that young fellow didn't give me $20 worth of gas. He didn't. I said, no, he didn't. The gas gauge hasn't moved. I know it was working. The gas gauge hasn't moved. Well, she said, what are you going to do? I said, there's nothing I can do now. I said, but he probably has a scam going, waiting for somebody like me, a tourist. And he probably put in about $2 worth. You know, now all of this is going through my mind. He probably put in $2 worth. So if I were to question, I saw the two. I thought it was 20. I'm sorry. He probably put in $2 worth, took the $20 in. He has $18. That rascal. I said, Louis, you see, you just have to stay on top of everything. What a scam. What a scam. I said, I'm going to have to put some more gas in when I get down to Treasure Key, so I pulled into another station. And when I got out, there was a girl and a boy there from Green Turtle, but the family runs the station there. And the little fella said, yes, sir. I said, give me $20 worth. Do you want it in the front tank or the back tank? So what do you mean, front tank or the back tank? Well, you see, you got two tanks. Oh, I said, which tank does Gene usually put the gas in? He said, the front one. The fella put the gas in the back one up in Marshall. And when I got in, I saw the button there that you push to go to the front tank or the back tank. And now they both were full. I didn't tell Gene about it for various reasons. But I mean, all the thoughts that I had about that young man in Marshall. He had put $20 worth of gas in the rear tank. But it didn't show because I had the front tank on the gauge. You see? I mean, but that's the way we are, isn't it? I mean, we come to our conclusions, we make our assumptions, and we say things that, we just don't know what we're talking about oftentimes. And we should keep our mouths shut. And you know, we can do a lot of damage by our words. I know what it says. Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. That is not true. Words do hurt us. And we are to encourage one another. We're to pray for one another. And whatsoever ye do in word. Now note that. That's Colossians 3:17. Whatsoever ye do in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks to God and the Father by Him. So they were all wrong in the book. And God is standing in the shadows, observing it all. And the next time, Sunday night, we're going to see that God speaks. After all of these people speak, and after Job does a lot of speaking, a lot of talking, God is going to deal with it. Then we're going to see Job in the hands of God and how he faces convictions. But right now, you join in with me as we sing. Have thine own way, Lord.